What's up, everyone? I am here with my buddy Guy Ventresca. Guy, did I pronounce that correctly?
Tresca, yeah.
Awesome, awesome.
It's an old Italian name like yours.
Yep, good Italian boys. So real quick, I'll just kind of update the audience on how we connected. So I think I had reached out to you maybe 2 months ago. I think you had seen one of my YouTube videos, and you had made a comment, and I responded back to you, and I said, "Hey, email me," because it was about a certain topic, about something that I wanted to chat with you more offline about. So, we've been going back and forth for really a few months now. You're super knowledgeable when it comes to the Iraqi dinar. That's why I wanted to get you on here, because as most of you know this, I am very anti-dinar guru, with all the date and rate promises that come and go. I'm just very tired of it. I believe the Iraqi dinar is a very real investment. I have been invested for 15 years now, and I would not have held on to the Iraqi dinar all these years if I thought, there was a possibility or a chance that it was going to go nowhere, right? I always say if they were going to redominate their currency and just chop off the zeros and have a net neutral event, they could have done it a long time ago, right? So there's a reason why they've been building out this monetary policy, and doing a lot of the financial mechanisms we're seeing in order, I believe, to establish a new rate. But before we get into all that, Guy, why don't you go ahead, introduce yourself? You have a very very impressive bio. So just inform, the viewers who you are and
Sure. First, I want to thank you for coming on this podcast because I found you just by accident. And your podcast is such a breath of fresh air compared to all the other stuff that you've mentioned already. So I just wanted to pay you that compliment. So like Stephen, I'm a nice Italian boy who grew up in the New York area. Went to Catholic school for 12 years and have flushed out most of the bad stuff associated with that. But one of the things it did is it gives you a fundamental understanding of Western civilization. And I became a big fan of history because of my Catholic education. In fact, I'm a guest lecturer at a Catholic preparatory school up at Westchester. So what happened is I went off to university. This was as the Vietnam War was winding down. And the month Saigon fell in April of 75, I'm older than I look, by the way, I signed a contract to become a U.S. Army officer upon graduation. And so I did that. I became a tank officer, an armor officer in the U.S. Army. And my first assignment was in Fort Hood, Texas. And my commanding general was the son of George Patton. So I served under a Patton. So that's sort of a legacy memory that I keep. So they shipped me off to Germany pretty quickly, and I ended up living in Germany for 12 years. I became a captain. I commanded a tank company at the very end of the Cold War. Actually, sorry, in 82, 83. Not quite at the end, but when the Cold War was ramping up to such serious heights that in 1983, the world almost ended three times in the space of 6 months and nobody knew it. I actually wrote a Substack article about that. 1983, the most dangerous year in human history. So the Army was going to promote me to major and send me to the Pentagon, and I didn't want the lobotomy, so I resigned. And I joined a computer firm called Wang Laboratories, and they had a very large defense contract with DoD and with NATO forces in Europe. So that was a great jump-off point for me to launch a new career. And this is when the computer industry was just ramping up, taking off. And for the next 20 years, I was in information technology, what younger generations call tech, but it was really IT. Now, I ended up in Berlin, and that was probably the best job of my life, other than being a tank company commander. I supported the Allied forces in West Berlin. I knew the commanding generals, the diplomats, the ambassadors, the spy chiefs. and the dozens of different intelligence agencies that operated during that time. Now, most of them have been consolidated under one big umbrella that is headed up the Defense Intelligence Agency. I was going to mention Tulsi Gabbard, but she's not at the head of BIA. She's the head of, she's the director of National Intelligence. So that my fundamental knowledge of history, my interest in how civilizations rise, peak, and then collapse, and then get replaced by a new one, I saw it happening live as the Soviet Union collapsed. The Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall fell, Germany united, Soviet Union collapsed, all in the space of a year or 2 years. And that set the stage for what was to come next. Because how do we navigate the post-Cold War world? Nobody really knew. Bill Clinton becomes president. My job disappears in Berlin. I get transferred to Washington, D.C. And that's when I lived in D.C. for 7 years, still with the same firm, and actually left Wang, went to other firms. But that's where I learned the mechanics of the military-industrial complex. And the plumbing is in contracts, procurement. If you want to understand how any industrial complex works, it's in procurement. So, and I was in the middle of that whole contracting thing. And that taught me a lot. And that's how I understood how things happen. So I went through various wake-up stages. I would say the JFK assassination was the very first wake-up call. Even though I was only 8 years old, I was too young to understand it. But I knew something horrible had happened to our nation. Then, of course, the whole Vietnam War. But then afterwards, you had Iran-Contra. I mean, anytime someone asks me, what exactly is the military-industrial complex? I tell them, just do a search, Iran-Contra explained in less than 10 minutes. And that's it. It's just a mess. And that's what happens when you have people with a lack of imagination or maybe too much wild imagination, and you give them billions of dollars and a military and intelligence apparatus to exploit their crazy ideas. You get people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld running a war that I would say was probably the greatest failure of our modern nation, was the second Gulf War, 2003. So let's bring this all around to the DNR. A lot of the men that I trained and worked with during the Cold War ended up going to Desert Storm. They were in Operation Desert Storm, otherwise known as the Gulf War. And what happened was, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he immediately went for the banks. And he confiscated their printing, and they started printing tons of Kuwaiti dinars. So Kuwait and Iraq have the same name for their currency, dinar, which actually is the original name of in ancient Rome, during the Roman Empire, the name of their currency was the denari. Yeah. So every now and then I have some old veteran buddies who call me and say, hey, what's going on with the denari? I said, wrong empire, buddy. So,
you know, it's funny. It's in the Bible, because my wife wasn't she wasn't ever a believer in the Iraqi dinar. And, you know, it's something I never really talked about much with her, because I'm like, Mom, you know, I just married this girl a few years ago. She didn't think, you know, oh my gosh, I married a crazy guy. And, you know, so she never really, you know, believed in it. She trusted me and my judgment. And then one day she went to Bible study, and, you know, that was a verse in the Bible, you know, where Jesus was talking about the denarius. And my wife's very big on signs. I actually did a video on this, you know, on YouTube a few months ago. And she took it as like a sign, like, oh, you know what? I know my husband, you know, was invested in this. And she kind of, that was her own, like her own confirmation that there was something there. You know, she doesn't obviously follow it as much as I do, but yeah, it's.
And, you know, a lot of the movements of the ancient world are reflected today. The American, I'd say the fate of the American empire is following the same path as that of the Roman Empire. We are in a very serious decline. But that's a separate subject. So went back to Saddam. He invades Kuwait in 1990, at the end of 1990, which was very convenient because the Cold War was over. What are we going to do with this massive land army that we have stationed in Germany? I mean, there were 500,000 NATO troops in Germany preparing to defend Europe from a Soviet invasion. I mean, they outnumbered us 8-1. I mean, our life expectancy was 72 hours at best. So, So when I say I served during the Cold War, it was peacetime, but it was very dangerous. And we were in constant training, and there were accidents, and people would lose limbs and die in accidents. It was some bad news. So that whole army had no purpose. Saddam's invasion of Kuwait gave them purpose. So that entire army was moved to Saudi Arabia to prepare for Desert Storm. And so a lot of my guys were in that. And they didn't know about the currency thing. But so Saddam confiscated all that money. The international banking world, the IMF, the World Bank, U.S. Treasury, they canceled the Kuwaiti dinar. It had zero worth. It was basically confetti to prevent Saddam from acquiring wealth from his confiscation. Then the war ended. Most of our soldiers went back to Europe. And then eventually there was a big reduction of the army. And they didn't have a chance to acquire the new Kuwaiti dinar, which was published actually by our printing office, because the Kuwaiti one was destroyed. But apparently, I have to verify this, it was only for institutional investors. So only banks, national treasuries, large institutions could purchase the new Kuwait dinar, which they did for, I forgot the rate, they bought it for pennies. And then it came out at 2-1 to the dollar. And today, the Kuwait dinar is the highest valued currency in the world. You can look it up right now. Go on your computer. It's what, $3.26 per Kuwait dinar, something like that?
Yeah. I actually did a video. The entire video was just comparing Iraq to Kuwait. I did that video. It's, if you go on my YouTube and go scroll down, you know, maybe a month or two ago. But that's what really blew me away. When I first started getting involved in this investment, you know, it made zero sense to me that these neighboring countries could be so vastly different, with, you know, Iraq having, you know, more natural resources, larger oil reserves. Why was their rate being artificially, you know, held, but also controlled? You know, like a lot of people don't realize, you know, they were doing currency auctions every single, you know, day for what, over 20 years, right? They just stopped the auctions, I think a year or two ago, to control the currency. Like, there have been so many mechanisms to intentionally, you know, have a program rate in place, while I believe a lot of the infrastructure, you know, has been built, but also to, and we could talk about this a little later, you know, all of the Iranian influence that has been involved and, you know, intertwined in Iraqi politics, in Iraqi, you know, the entire monetary system has been greatly influenced, money smuggling through Maliki, through a lot of his cronies too. So there's been a lot of things happening, but the basics still, I mean, it's funny. I just had this conversation with a few people earlier today who aren't, you know, they don't really know much about the Iraqi dinar. I go, put the whole faith aspect aside. If you just look at the basic fundamentals of Iraq and their financial, you know, policies, and just look at Kuwait, if you just do a deep dive just on that thing, just comparing both countries, you're going to come to the conclusion that it makes zero logical sense why Kuwait has the highest highest currency rate in the world, and their neighbor Iraq has, you know, one of the lowest, if not the lowest, currency rate in the world. Like, it just doesn't make any logical sense. So,
but there's a reason for it. Things had gone so well with Gulf War I and with Kuwait, that when Bush Jr. came into office, along with Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, they thought they could recreate the same scenario. They thought they could invade Iraq with less than half the size army that was used in 91. And Cheney should have known this. He was the defense secretary back then. He should have known this, but But he just, there's a friend of mine, a very good a commentator. You'll see him on YouTube, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. And he's a guest on many shows. And he often says they needed adult supervision. Rumsfeld and Cheney were probably a great historical example of the Peter Principle. They were elevated to a position beyond their capacity. So they go, they push George into Gulf War II, 2003, invasion of Iraq, and they think it's going to be a cake. And then Cheney actually made a statement. Some reporter asked him, who's going to pay for this war? The Iraqis are going to pay for it, because he knew what happened to Kuwait in 1992, it was, 92, 93. And his idea was, we'll do the same thing. We'll cancel out the Saddam Iraq dinar. We'll publish a brand new Iraq dinar. We'll help establish a new republic, a democratic republic in Iraq. You know, we're going to bring Jeffersonian democracy to the Middle East. That's what they said. It's like, these guys are smoking crack. So, I mean, all you have to do for reference is watch the movie Lawrence of Arabia. Then you'll understand how chaotic things are in the Middle East and why it takes them forever to get things done.
And as Americans too, we don't understand the cultural or the culture, right? Like, we think in just logical terms, oh, this is how it is here. There's hundreds and thousands of years of culture there. And then you add their religion into it as well. And it's like, you know, what seems to be obvious as far as these governmental changes or, you know, monetary changes or policy changes, it doesn't work that way over there. Like, things are very, very different. And, you know, even when you look at the war with Iran, you know, for them, it's more of a religious war, right? I mean, we're fighting a country where if you die, you know, it's essentially martyrdom, you know, for them. Whereas, you know, obviously we're trying to, you know, not have boots on the ground and trying to do this, you know, as quickly and easily as possible. But a lot of Americans don't understand the culture differences. And I think that's the mistake a lot of the governmental agencies made and past presidents too, is, you know, without knowing those intricacies involved, you know, you're fighting something that you don't really know how intertwined and how deep and how long it's going to take. If it ever gets corrected or fixed, or if we ever actually claim victory, right? So it's a multi-generational thing.
And what happened is it doomed your generation to a nonstop deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, the two forever wars, and to a global war on terror. So now we have millions of veterans who are just having a really hard time with life, readjusting. But let's go back to, so post 2003, the U.S. really botched the occupation and the recovery of Iraq. I mean, they did almost everything wrong you could possibly think of, and things that you wouldn't think of. So yes, we created a new Iraq dinar, which you can still buy today. They printed it and they made it available to non-accredited investors. So for the first time, Joe Public, you and I, could go to a licensed exchange and buy this practically worthless currency. And the reason I did it back, I started roughly like you did 15 years ago, is because I knew what happened to Kuwait. And I knew what Cheney and Rumsfeld's idea, I knew their idea, what they wanted to do was sound. It's how they went about doing it that was a complete disaster. And that's why it's taken so long. That's the primary reason. Because the U.S. not only defeated Iraq in a war, we then ripped the spine out of all their infrastructure. We turned the country into a basket case. They had to rebuild everything. Their water systems, sewage systems, electricity, roads, transportation, airports. I mean, it was not the same as Kuwait. Kuwait recovered very quickly, because their infrastructure was not destroyed. But Iraq was. And plus, Iraq is not, it's a pluralistic society. It's Muslim, Christian, and Kurd. And within the Muslim world, there's the two branches, the Shia and the Sunni. So the Shia are allied to Iran, and the Sunni are allied to Saudi Arabia. And then there's a class division. So a lot of the working class people in Iraq are Shia, but the elitists, they're called the Ba'athists, the ones who ran the government, they're Sunni. So there was this constant friction, and the U.S. didn't understand it. It took forever to get a government started. Then you had this bozo named Maliki that you made reference to. He started making inroads. The U.S. actually installed him as the new prime minister for a while. He was prime minister for two or three terms. And so that prevented the kind of economic progress that we were banking, that all of us who originally bought the dinar. And I think that's the reason why we're still waiting. But the fundamental justification for this currency still exists. It's still there. And it's actually stronger than Kuwait, because as you mentioned, Iraq has more oil than Kuwait does. It has more sweet crude. So it's number five in the world for total oil reserves, but number three for sweet crude. And sweet crude's necessary to refine into jet fuel, gasoline, and finer petroleum products. But it's also, because of the high-tech revolution we've gone through in the last 20 years, rare earth minerals are extremely important, because almost all of the rare earth minerals we need are coming from China. Well, our military is relying upon those, and we're getting them from our supposed enemy. I mean, this, by the way, this kind of double dealing and side trading happens in every war. World War One, World War Two, happens all the time. There's a documentary called Every War is a Banker's War. If you want to understand how money works, I recommend watching that.
Let me ask you this, Guy.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest, I almost call it negatives, but really the biggest hesitation a lot of people have, or really probably the most common question I get, is that the money supply is too large, right? Like Iraq's money supply is out of control. I think I haven't even looked at the numbers recently. It's, what is it, 130 trillion or 130 billion dinar to be handed.
In circulation.
And therefore, because their money supply is so large, right, revaluing is technically an impossibility, because, you know, it would blow up the money supply and it would actually destroy the country rather than help it. And I think it's a very valid argument. I mean, I think people have a right to, because I asked that same question when I got involved, right? Because if your money, like Kuwait did not have, you know, their money supply is not as large as Iraq. But what people fail to realize too is Kuwait has a population of, I think, like 6 million. Iraq has a population of 45 to 50 million, right? So very different country sizes as well. Even though, funny enough, both of their inflation rates are actually very close. I think Kuwait is like the high 2% range. Iraq is around 3%. So, you know, their inflation rates have been controlled, which is another reason why the Iraqi dinar, you know, being so low doesn't really make much sense. But what pushback would you have on that argument? I mean, I'm happy to share mine, but I would like to hear from you. Like, what would your argument to that be, or your pushback, for the money
supply? So my understanding is this: because of all the destruction that I mentioned earlier, they literally had to rebuild the country from the ground up, and they've decided to do it digitally. So the idea of the smart city and the smart nation that we've heard of from all the technocrats, they're actually doing it there. So the entire population is used to spending money and doing exchanges digitally. And because of that, again, I'm not saying this is the only answer, but it's the one that makes sense to me. The government and the entire banking system issued internal debit cards that can only be used domestically. And once everyone inside Iraq, let's say the reinstatement occurs, there's a big announcement. The Iraqi dinar is now 1-to-1 with the US dollar, or it's worth $2 or $3 or $7. Pipe dreams.
We can only hope. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, let's say it's 1.5. And you had a great, you told us about the dream you had, 1.8 to 1. That would be a great starting point. So let's say that's announced and all the people in Iraq rush to the banks. They bring their mattress covers full of all their mattress money and they dump it all. They're not going to get U.S. dollars. They're not going to get cash. They're going to get their digital accounts charged up. And their internal debit cards will have a spending limit. They will not be able to fly to Monaco and spend all that money at the casino. Okay. They can't, they must spend it internally.
Right. So their purchasing power increases. So they do benefit greatly from this. But the argument has always been all Iraqis are going to be overnight millionaires, like us speculators who hold their currency outside of Iraq, right? Which isn't true. Internally in the country, their purchasing power is going to increase, but they're not going to become overnight millionaires, you know, like you would suspect, thinking that, you know, their dinars are now, you know, going to be, you know, work.
And remember, this is a modern industrial country. They have a highly educated workforce. Those are entrepreneurial people. They want to start businesses and they've been hamstrung. They can't. And now they can't. Once this happens, their economy will flourish. And here's the thing about the international investors, us. We're holding the same dinars as the people of Iraq. There is no way that the banking system can say, oh, we're only doing it internally. We're not accepting your dinars. That's impossible. You can't do that. This is a valid currency. It's a recognized currency by the IMF and the World Bank and all the national treasuries. It's just not tradable today. It's considered exotic. But the moment that restriction is lifted, and my understanding is all the external restrictions are lifted, it's strictly up to Iraq to flip the switch, to push that button, pull that trigger, you know, pick whatever metaphor you want. And it's all their internal squabbling that has prevented it. But now, I want to do a small dovetail. When President Bush assigned Scott Bessent as the Treasury Secretary, he announced the stablecoin as the new.
You mean when Trump signed?
Yeah, the Genius Act, and now followed by the Clarity Act, which is going to pass soon. All the U.S. dollars are going to be converted to stablecoins. Now Bessent has a strategy. In case I'm assuming everyone has heard about the petrodollar. So the strength of the U.S. dollar is not backed by gold. It's not backed by anything. It's called a fiat currency for a reason. Fiat is Latin for by decree.
And real quick, right? This is just going back to the money supply argument. Okay. I always tell people, what do you think your one U.S. dollar, your paper dollar in your wallet is backed by, right? Like you said. It's not backed by gold, right? We came off the gold reserve what in the 70s.
44. Oh, we came off of it in 71.
Yeah. It's not backed by oil. It's not backed by our US dollar is backed by the good faith of the good old USA because we said it's worth this, right? And the USA is a pretty stable country, so why would we argue with them, right? But it's like, okay, well, if that's the case, then now we're holding Iraq to a difference. And again, obviously two very different countries, but you know, still when you look at the fundamentals of money supply and currency valuations, it's not like, you know, a country's currency is, you know, there's this rule list that every country can only, you know, have their currency valued at such a rate based on, you know, this list of things, right? It's very different. So, and what a lot of people don't realize is Iraq, again, has been sucking in physical dinar through these currency auctions they've been doing all of these years. So I personally have always believed that the money supply is actually a lot lower than what they've presented, you know, in their audits as well. So, you know, but yeah.
So their the value of their currency should be very high because not just because of their oil reserves, their rare earth minerals, they've just discovered silica. in the desert. Silica is absolutely necessary for all high technology components. So the country has an incredible potential. And what we're doing on our side, if Scott Bessent's strategy works, the Treasury Secretary, stablecoins will be backed by a combination of gold and U.S. treasuries. So they will no longer be a fiat currency. It'll be backed by something. Now, U.S. treasuries have value. I know everyone's hearing stories, the dollar's going down and the value of the currency is worthless and all. No, it's not. Every single national treasury and major bank in the world is holding tons of U.S. treasuries. Therefore, they're holding U.S. dollars. Almost, what is it? I think the 65% of all monetary transactions in the world are conducted in U.S. dollars. There's a reason.
And Iraq just increased their treasury reserve by 80% in the last 12 months. I mean, what does that tell you right there? Like, I actually did a deep dive on a former video talking about that. But I mean, that's a, you know, I think that was a large tell of, you know, what they're getting ready to do in the near future. So
I think the takeaway is all of these machinations going on behind the scenes that the public is not aware of, that, to be honest, it's kind of hard to explain it to the layperson, but it's there. It's real. You know, all these mechanisms are designed to spread prosperity and wealth throughout the world. And this is a chance, not just for the 1% to gain, but for all of us to gain. And that's why I'm not just a true believer. I know it's going to happen.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Like I said, you know, part of my belief is faith-based, but also a large part of it is just fundamental. You know, I mean, when you look at the fundamentals of what's going on, it really just makes sense. And when you look at everything happening behind the scenes with what Trump is doing policy-wise, you know, with the entire monetary system, like he just put out a tweet the other day talking about a large reset coming. No one really knows what he's alluding to. Some people think it's going to be a financial reset. Like, no one really knows. But I mean, just look at what's happening in the crypto markets and, you know, with certain cryptocurrencies. I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day. I'm like, you know, when you wire money, like when I want to fund my investment account, right? Let's say I want to go buy, you know, $20,000 worth of a new cryptocurrency. I have to go to my bank. I have to fill out a form, wire it. It takes usually, you know, 2 to 3 business days to hit my account. Then I could finally start investing. Well, if that's the case, I just missed my buy opportunity, you know, maybe when that crypto was 15% lower, right? So the entire monetary system is a very outdated system. And then, you know, there are cryptocurrencies, you know, like Ripple, XRP, you know, that have been created to, you know, to help and offset, you know, these types of, you know, issues. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to really see what's going on, right? Like if you would have had this conversation with someone maybe 10 years ago, you would sound like a conspiracy theorist. And that's why I really haven't talked about this with anyone for the last 15 years. And I felt led one day to start recording a video about the dinar because I really didn't talk to anyone about it, including my own family. I mean, my dad is invested as well. So me and him, it would be like our father-son conversation, right? At the end of the day, we would FaceTime each other and just talk about the news or what, you know, what's happening or, you know, hey, what did you hear? What did I hear? Right. So it was kind of like a fun thing we had together. But I have always felt like this is a very, very real investment. I feel like it's really right in front of us. I think with the Iran war happening right now, even though it's been, you know, 6 weeks now, I believe that was a large stepping stone that had to happen for everything else to fall into place, because Iran had a large chokehold on the country of Iraq. And I truly believe until Iran was dealt with and got that their grip off of the country of Iraq, you know, there was probably going to be no increase in the currency. I mean, that's just my own personal belief. You know, I would love to hear, you know, your thoughts on that.
Well, of course, in the last few months, a lot of people who I turned on to this investment have contacted me and said, well, what about the war? How's this? Isn't this going to throw everything off? And I said, well, there's always deep layers of operations going on behind the headlines. Underneath the headlines, there's a lot going. And I'm not absolutely against this war on all counts. The level of human suffering has just ramped up a thousandfold from already bad situation. But it's to remove the lock grip, for lack of a better word, that Iran has over much of the region, and to allow countries like Iraq to profit. And so the war is breaking up a bad infrastructure, a bad relationship structure between nations of that region. I just wish it could have been done another way. I wish it was there was some kind of economic mechanism to get the same result as war. But unfortunately, when you've got a giant military industrial complex like both Israel and the U.S. have, their first every problem is presented as the nail, and they bring out the hammer.
I agree. Obviously, war is never, you know, never the answer, and innocent lives are lost. And Iran has a population of 90 million people, right? 80% of those people are, you know, they're against the regime, and you know, then you have a small percentage that are for, you know, for the current regime. And you know, it's been a terrorist state, you know, for the last almost 50 years now, right? So I truly believe if it wasn't dealt with now, my kids, grandkids, we're going to have to deal with it at some point in the future. I mean, we're deep in it now, right? There's really no going back. So whether you're for it or against it, I mean, you know, I do think we just have to finish what we started. And I think today there were reports now that Iran agreed to open the Strait of Hormuz, which is why the markets are taking off today. And, you know, crypto's up, the Dow's up. I think it was up 600 points at one point. So, you know, again, a lot of it does remain to be seen. But I do think at the end of the day, it was a strategic decision that is going to accelerate what we're looking for on the investment side with the dinar versus, you know, possibly holding for another 3, 5, 10 years.
Yeah. And here's another thing I forgot to mention. Iraq is actually the promised land of the Middle East now. It's no longer the Saudis or the Emirates or Qatar or Oman or Bahrain. They're, by the way, they've all had their oil infrastructure attacked and maybe reduced by 30 or 40% by Iran. Iran's launched tons of missiles. So it's not just closing the Straits of Hormuz that's going to choke off all the products that come out of the Middle East. It's the fact that all those refineries and oil extraction facilities are knocked out. They have to be rebuilt. But Iraq has already rebuilt much of, they've recovered from that war, that 2003 war. And now because they're implementing the smart city approach across their whole nation. Now, I know a lot of people listening to this might be libertarians, and they're against the surveillance state and the idea of a smart city, of making everything digital. I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. But Iraq decided to go that route, and they want everything digital. And that means most of the other Middle Eastern countries are still living in the 19th century or the 18th century culturally. Iraq is a modern nation. They can actually become the rising star of the Middle East. And I think that's another reason why this currency is going to happen.
Yep. Let's have some fun with this. And you've been great. Thank you for all your knowledge and wisdom. I enjoy these conversations. Let's talk about timeline. What do you think or feel? I mean, based on the war, we have a new Iraqi president who was just elected 6 days ago.
And Kurdish, yeah.
Yep. And we're within that 14-day window of him, you know, forming the government, selecting a prime minister. So this could happen in the next, I mean, it could happen any day now because we are within that 14-day window. That's exciting. And, you know, a lot of people have said that they're just going to elect Sudani again. because he already has a government formed. So they're possibly going to go that route. Maliki's name is still being thrown around, which I don't know how that guy is still around, but he is. I don't think anything is going to come of it. And Trump made, again, going back to America being involved in Iraqi politics, Trump made a statement a few months ago calling Maliki out directly saying, hey, Iraq, if you elect this guy again, like America is no longer supporting you. That right there tells you a lot, you know, if you read between the lines and if you are invested in the dinar. But just for fun, I mean, where do you think we're at right now? From what you're seeing, what do you think the timeline is?
So with the caveat that we don't give rates and we don't give dates, this is purely, it's an educated guess. I still believe in the month of April as the abundance month, not just because it begins with the letter A, but there are certain things going on both materially and spiritually, because we're both spiritual people, that the month of April looks very, very powerful for this event to occur. But it might bleed over into May. So I'm, again, like you, I'm heavily invested. I've been waiting a long time. Waiting another month is no big deal. If we go in deep into May, fine, but I really feel, what's today now, the 17th, 18th? I think a month from now, within a month from now, we're going to have our blessing.
I hope so. I uploaded a video yesterday saying that I think, you know, I thought we're in a 12-month window, right? And people got mad at me, like, what do you mean 12 months? It's going to be sooner. I'm like, listen, I wish it happened yesterday, okay? No one wants this to happen more than me, guys like you who have been involved in this for, you know, over a decade, right? But I'm also realistic with my timelines, and I don't like to hope and wish for something and then it comes and goes and now you're let down, because that's how you get burned out on this, right? And there was a time and period after I had gotten invested with the Iraqi dinar, I said, you know what? I'm tired of this. I'm putting it away and I'll think about it when the revaluation happens. That's when I'll open up my safe again, right? Because if you're just constantly watching these, and I'm even sharing this with my audience, like, don't even just, you know, watch dinar videos all day, even my videos all day, right? Like, take a break from it. Take a break from my videos. Like, I'm doing this because I enjoy it. I'm heavily invested. I believe in it. And, you know, there's a lot of exciting things happening geopolitically with the Iraqi government. And just, you know, I believe we are in a very crucial timeline right now. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. Doesn't mean it's going to happen this month. Doesn't mean it's going to happen this year. No one wants it to happen more than me, but, you know, I also try to be as realistic as possible. This way I'm not constantly dangling the carrot, hoping and praying, you know, and then only to be disappointed, right? Because if you wake up every day thinking it's Christmas and it's not, you're going to get, you know, down, upset, frustrated. And I always tell people, go about, like, live your life, right? Focus on yourself, your family, your job, your business, whatever that is. When it happens, it happens. And I do believe we are a day closer today than we were yesterday, right? And if you look at all of the you know, events happening and you know, things happening around the world, you know, we are closer than ever. But like you said, listen, could April be our month? Of course it can. Could it May be our month? Of course it can, right? I think Iraq has to go digital by July. They set their own timeline to where they said they have to be completely digital by July. Does that mean the Iraqi dinar has to revalue by then? I hope so, right? But again, we don't know. We're speculating, but I think you and I are both on the same page that.
And there's some recent, there's some recent news about finally removing the three zeros from the value, which is, many people say that's an important first step. First, remove three zeros, then shift, then move that decimal point.
And I always tell people too, when you see, you know, because we've seen articles about removing the three zeros for the last 25 years, right? And it's like, Iraq is never going to tell you when they're planning on revaluing. They're not going to put out an article today saying, hey, Iraq is going to revalue their currency, you know, on April 20th, right? Everyone go out and buy as much as you can. Leverage your home, take a mortgage out and go buy more dinar. It's not going to happen that way, right? So when you see articles that say delete the zeros, that doesn't mean revaluation, right? But a lot of the articles that Iraq does put out is to educate their own citizens, right? And try to educate them and tell them, you know, what they're planning on doing. But again, you also can't take that as gospel truth because there's also misinformation campaigns that they put out as well, right? To throw people off, kind of like here in the States. You know, if you watch Fox or CNN or MSNBC, you're going to have three very different opinions of, you know, what's happening, you know, with what's going on, right? So it's the same thing there.
The best thing you can do as an investor in this particular thing is have a game plan. Think about, you know, obviously if you have debt, you're going to get out of debt. Okay. You want to improve your life. So think about, have a game plan, have a list, a massive to-do list. And the first thing on it better not be going to Las Vegas. It shouldn't be on that list at all.
Yeah. But and that's, you know, yeah. And I want to be very clear. I'm almost a little bit selfish by wanting to create these videos because I've been able to connect with guys like you, right? And we've had a lot of in-depth conversations offline where we're kind of picking each other's brains. You have connections that, you know, that you've shared with me about, you know, structuring, you know, certain holding, you know, avenues, whether it's trust or whether it's LLCs, right? So we've had these offline conversations. So it's been very, very cool to build this, you know, build these connections and build this community. And I'm working on putting together a, you know, a dinar community where we could all connect and, you know, have these conversations, because I always tell people, as soon as the revaluation happens, that excitement, you know, is going to last maybe a few hours, but then you're going to be hit with a holy crap. Like, when you're responsible for a significant amount of wealth, it's overwhelming. It's stressful because now you have to manage this money, right? So,
and, yeah. And remember, all the families that made incredible wealth 100 years ago, almost all of them have disappeared, except one, the Rockefellers.
Yeah. What was that book? That I actually bought it on Amazon. It hasn't been sent to my house just yet. What was the name of that book that you shared with me the other day?
Yeah, I don't mind plugging this. It's called What Would the Rockefellers Do by Garrett Gunderson. It's $7 on Amazon. Order it now. It's just it's a very good explanation of what this family did. They didn't just structure their wealth. They lobbied Congress to create the laws that would allow exemptions and protection for the wealth class to protect their assets. So the Rockefeller family is a great, you know, you can call them evil and the controllers and the, you know, but you want to mimic at your level what they did at their level. And you can do it. You can do it with this, you know, even if you just have $100,000. You can still follow the principles in this book to protect your wealth for the subsequent generations. And then the other one I want to plug is from Robert Kiyosaki's CPA, Tom Wheelwright. What's it called? Tax-free wealth?
Tax-free.
Yeah, Tom Wheelwright. I met him at a conference where I met Robert Kiyosaki. Great guy. And he really knows his stuff. And also, you know, it's written in a common, everyday language. It's not that technical. You can figure it out. You want to, oh, and Stephen, I want to mention something. In the comments section of a lot of your videos, people are saying, well, I thought Trump's going to eliminate the income tax and the IRS, so we don't have to worry about this. Boys and girls, I'm here to tell you. The income tax is embedded in the Constitution. It's in the 16th Amendment. Congress is not going to eliminate the income tax. If they did, the entire structure of the government would have to be redone.
Because I try to go through comments on my videos, you know, usually the next day, if I have some time, you know, just to kind of see what people are saying or the feedback I'm getting. And I cannot begin to tell you last night, last night's video had so many comments talking about, you know, well, why am I going to pay taxes? Why am I going to set aside taxes? Or talking about, I'm like, listen, guys, for those of you who are not going to pay your taxes, it's not going to be a good ending for you. Okay. That is not the case. I don't know where you're getting your information from, who you're listening to, right? Make sure you set aside, I personally am planning on setting aside, you know, 50% right out the gate, just to be safe, to make sure everything is handled, right? And obviously having a good CPA chip away at that and make sure that I'm paying as little as possible. For those of you who think that you're not going to have to pay taxes, or they're going to, you know, get rid of the IRS in the next 12 months, right? I'm sorry, it's very, very foolish. And I really hope you guys do not plan on doing that, because
don't be like Wesley Snipes. Wesley Snipes made a huge mistake and he paid for it. By the way, the organization behind this book, it's called The Wealth Factory. I don't get anything for referring you to them, but you can go to thewealthfactory.com, and they have services that they offer to help you set up your tax structure. And I'm sure Tom Wheelwright does the same thing. So, but you want to do something. It doesn't matter what. But here's one of the questions nobody can answer. When this happens, will the IRS, first of all, it's going to be a taxable event. You're going to go to a bank, you're going to convert the currency, and they're going to report it to the IRS. It's a taxable event. The thing we don't know, is it going to be taxes income? Is it going to be long-term capital gains, short-term capital gains? We don't know. I'm not even sure the IRS knows at this point. So you just want to be ready. And you want to be mentally prepared to set aside a portion of your gain for tax purposes.
Agree 100%. Guy, it has been a pleasure, my man. I've enjoyed our conversations. I enjoy our offline talks, and you know, we're obviously going to continue to have those, you know, as my newfound dinar buddy. And again, guys, I am working right now on putting together a community group, you know, off of YouTube, to get everyone just, you know, connected, because again, when this does happen, you're going to be looking for, you know, like-minded individuals who are going through exactly what you're going through, who might have a different perspective or, you know, certain knowledge that you're going to need to make sure that you keep as much of your investment as possible. And even post revaluation, right? Investment opportunities. Like, I've been looking at investing into, you know, I'm a real estate guy. I've been looking at investing into data centers, right? I've talked about Section 8 housing, you know, with this new AI revolution. You know, owning data centers is going to be extremely, extremely profitable. Like, it's a big real estate play right now, and it's only going to be exploding. And, you know, how cool would it be to have a group of hundreds of, you know, if not maybe 1,000 dinar investors who are now worth millions, multi-millions, billions of dollars, who can come together and, you know, syndicate deals, meaning, you know, we're all investing in the same things, or, you know, leveraging risk or sharing investments with each other, saying, hey, I'm investing in this, you know, here's what it looks like. Maybe you should too. Just having that community of like-minded individuals, I think it's going to be one of the most powerful things. So, Guy, I appreciate, you know, you and you sharing your knowledge and expertise here. It's been fun.
No, absolutely. And it flowed well, and it was an effortless conversation. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you guys for watching the video. And make sure you like and subscribe to the channel. This way you're always notified when I drop a new video. And until next time, we'll chat soon.